You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You
We're reading the Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Heidegger, and we're starting tonight with section 7, called Of the Event. Yeah, I guess that's it, right?
Yeah.
It's been cold, it's been snowy, here we are in the yurt at night. It's warm in here though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable and ready to go?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to start reading, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. 7. Of the Event. How remote from us is the God that appoints us ones who ground and create because the God's essence needs these. So remote is the God that we are unable to decide whether he is moving toward or away from us. To think fully and inventively, this remoteness itself, in its essential occurrence as the time-space of the highest decision, means to ask about the truth obeying, about the event itself, from which all future history arises, provided there will still be history. Should I keep going?
Yeah.
Okay. This remoteness of the undecidability of the outermost and the first is what stands in the clearing on behalf of self-concealment and is the essential occurrence of truth itself as the truth of being. For what is self-concealing of this clearing, the remoteness of the undecidability, is no mere objectively present and irrelevant void, but is the essential occurrence of the event as the very essence of the event, of the hesitant self-withholding which, as belonging, already appropriates Dasein, and is the retention of the moment and of the site of the first decision.
Yeah, that's probably enough.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
I got lost.
Yeah. How remote from us is the God that appoints us, ones who ground and create, because the God's essence needs these. So he just asks a question, how far away is this God that decides that we are the ones that must ground and create because he needs it? So remote is the God, and he answers it, so remote that we are unable to decide whether he is moving toward or away from us. So, you know, when you see something way far off and you're not sure if it's coming towards you or away from you, it's a long ways away. But it's interesting right away that he's giving a kind of a spatial dimension to God.
Mm-hmm.
To think fully and inventively, this remoteness itself in its essential occurrence as the time space of the highest decision. So to ponder over fully and inventively this remoteness, which is an occurrence of the time space of the highest decision, means to ask about the truth of bang. So the truth of bang, asking about the truth of bang, has something to do with thinking about this remoteness. It is to ask about the event itself, from which all future history arises, provided there will still be history. So it's to ask about the event, what the event is, what the truth of Bang is. And from that event, if we can see the event, if there ever is an event, if events still exist, from which all future history will arise, provided there will still be history. Which is interesting because I think he's raising the idea that maybe there won't be history.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there won't be events.
In the other beginning.
That's right.
I'm not sure he's saying there won't be events.
Okay.
But I think he is postulating history might not
be. Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I would say, you know, you're right. He doesn't say here whether there will be events. But my kind of sense is that what is history? History is a series of events, maybe. And if there's no history, it's because there's – why would there be no history? Because he said provided there will still be history.
Yeah.
There would be no history because there are no events. There are no events – because we have not found the truth of Bang.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of an event for me, because this section is called Of the Event, raises the question of whether we can see and understand and come to ground and think about events, which mm-hmm. would generate history, without which there would be no history, there would just be historiology.
Mm-hmm.
This remoteness of the undecidability of the outermost and the first. I feel like the outermost and the first means God.
Oh.
This remoteness of the undecidability of how far away God is what stands in the clearing on behalf of self-concealment and is the essential occurrence of truth itself as the truth of Bang. So this remoteness of the undecidability of the outermost and the first, that's the subject of the sentence. Is this remoteness stands in the clearing on behalf of self-concealment, so kind of in its stead, representing it on behalf of it, and is the essential currents of truth itself as the truth of Bang. So I get it's very strange. This remoteness of the undecidability of the outermost and the first is the essential currents of truth. As the truth of Bang. Phew. For what is self-concealing of this clearing? For what is the self-hiding of this clearing? What is the remoteness of the undecidability? Is no mere objectively present and irrelevant void. It's not just a banal, undefinable, objective present and an irrelevant void. But it's the essential occurrence of the event as the very essence of the event. So this the clearing that we see of this self-concealing, so the coming out of the self-hiding into the remoteness of the undecidability of the outermost and the first is not just a simple, oh, look, the world's present to me. Oh, there's just an irrelevant present, a void present. It's actually the essential occurrence of the event is the very essence of the event. So there it is. That's the event. And it is the retention of the moment and of the sight of the first decision. So he's really almost, to me, he's sort of describing a kind of a internal architectural landscape whereby the event is perceived. Via this space in which a remote God is moving in the distance, not knowing whether he's coming or we're not knowing whether he's coming and going. We're trying to think this remoteness fully. We're trying to perceive an event. We're perceiving the clearing of a self-concealing, the coming out of a self-concealed thing. And we're trying to come to a realization that it's not just a mere objective present and irrelevant void. I think that's probably the most important point here. He talks about this other times. It's like when we think of being and being a being and having being and living as a being among beings, presence or the present, what's objectively present or what's kind of right in front of us, the chronological present and the spatial present, is taken to be just kind of like a neutral, neutered, vague, voidish space, or just it's a given. There's nothing definable about it. There's nothing distinct mm-hmm. about it. And he's saying there, it's actually, that's not the case. It's actually the essential, this self-concealing of the clearing and the remoteness of the undecidability is the event itself, the very essence mm-hmm. of the event. So it's all pretty mysterious, mm-hmm. but I think if you kind of imagine it and kind of try to put your mind into it and try to almost experience it, like mm-hmm. the idea of these distances and events and, you know, it starts to feel like, would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. What's the first decision? I guess maybe he hasn't said yet. Or has he?
Yeah, where do you see that phrase?
First, the very end of that paragraph.
Okay, so he says, what is self-concealing of this clearing? The remoteness of the undecidability is the essential currents of the event as the very essence of the event, and is the retention of the moment and of the site of the first decision. Mm-hmm. So retention would be that we experience the event as a relevant, a non-objective present. Mm-hmm. And we retain it as a moment, and we retain it as a site of the first decision, as a site wherein our mm-hmm. decision vis-a-vis the event, the first decision we will make in relation to it, will take place. 'Cause Heidegger's a lot about this idea of real decisions and finding decidable spaces and decidable parameters and where decidability actually lies, not making false decisions. And I think he's encouraging us to go to the event and realize that the first decision, like the actual first decision we need to make before we make other decisions, lies there, not before, not in preparation, not in historiology, not in an ideological conceptualization that will then kind of enshroud and conceal the event. We want to withhold decision. We want to experience the event, and then we want to make the first decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. I guess you want to keep reading?
Going? Or? Sure, yeah.
Okay.
In the essence of the truth of the event, everything true is simultaneously decided and grounded. Beings come to be and non-beings slip into the semblance of being. This remoteness is at once the farthest and for us the first, nearness to the God, but also the plight of the abandonment by being, which is concealed by the lack of a sense of plight evident in the avoidance of meditation today. In the essential occurrence of the truth of being, in the event and as the event, the last God is hidden.
Mm.
Yeah.
Should we unpack that a little bit?
Sure.
In the essence of the truth of the event, everything true is simultaneously decided and grounded. So what is true is grounded and decided in the truth of the event. That's where truth lies, and that's where truth is grounded. That's where beings come to be. So the truth of the event is kind of a being factory. And that's where non-beings slip into the semblance of bang. Semblance of bang.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Well, that's where non-beings slip into the appearance of having bang.
I see. Okay.
This remoteness is at once the farthest and for us the first nearness to the God. So this remoteness of the God is the farthest the farthest nearness to the God. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But also, the plight of the abandonment by being, which is concealed by the lack of a sense of plight evident in the avoidance of meditation today. So, this remoteness, and so he lurches back to the word remoteness, which he uses earlier, the remoteness of the undecidability, the remoteness of the God. This remoteness is the farthest and first nearness to the God that we will experience. So we get near to the God, and it's a kind of a first nearness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that nearness to the God is the farthest from us. It's the farthest nearness we will encounter. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I would say, like mm-hmm. the most distant intimacy we have,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the plight of the abandonment by being. So, but it's also indicative of those who have been abandoned by being and whose plight that is. A plight that is concealed by the fact that we don't have a sense of a plight, which Heidegger says is evident in us avoiding meditation. Right?
Yeah.
And I don't think he means meditation in a Zen monastery. I think he means probably, I'd have to look at the German, but he just means thinking.
Mm. Hm.
Thinking without deciding. In the essential occurrence of the truth of Bang, in the event and as the event, the last God is hidden. So we the last God is hidden. Not seen, but hidden.
Yeah.
Why don't you read a little more?
Yeah.
Wait, it's a bizarre word he uses here. Christianizing. Yeah. You know, this is the first time he's mentioned any religion of any sort, I think. I mean, he's used the word God, but go ahead.
Yeah. The long Christianizing of the God and the increasing promulgation of every attuned relation to beings have, just as obdurately as hiddenly, undermined the preconditions in virtue of which something is situated in the remoteness of the undecidability regarding the absconding or advent of the God, whose essential occurrence, nevertheless, is most intimately experienced. And this, to be sure, by a knowledge that stands in the truth only by being creative. To create, in the broad sense in which it is intended here, refers to any sheltering of the truth in beings.
Yeah, so he talks about the Christianizing, the long Christianizing, 2,000 years of the God. So the Christianization of the God and the increasing promulgation of every attuned relation to beings. So those are two really important points. The God has been Christianized, mm-hmm. which means the God is not Christian. The God has been Christianized, and our relationship with it has been Christianized. Because you can only eyes something that does not have that eyesness. The long Christianizing of the God and the kind of increasing spread of attuned relation to beings. So the increasing promulgation or distribution or evangelization of attuned relation to beings. So of customized or standardized or attuned to the Christianization of the God. So being, our relation to beings have been attuned to a Christianized God. So this Christianization of our God and our relation to beings undermined the preconditions in virtue of which something is situated in the remoteness of the undecidability regarding the absconding or advent of the God. So this Christianization has undermined those preconditions by which something is situated in the remoteness of the undecidability regarding the remoteness of the undecidability regarding the coming or going of the God. So Christianization of this whole situation of God and our attunement to beings has undermined those essential laws or situations by which something could even become present in this remote undecidability regarding the coming or going of the God.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Whose essential occurrence, that God, nevertheless, is most intimately experienced, even though this Christianization and this attuning has kind of ruined it, whose essential occurrence, nevertheless, is most intimately experienced. And this, to be sure, it's experienced via a knowledge that stands in the truth only by being creative. And then, creative. So that means like writing poems and songs and stuff. Now, being one of the creative class, right, as they call it. No, he says, to create, what I mean by to create here refers to the sheltering of the truth in beings. I have no idea what that means. But yeah. That's an interesting definition of creating.
Yeah.
Sheltering the truth in beings. Does that mean you shelter the truth in beings, or you shelter the truth of beings?
Mm.
Right? Are the beings the shelter?
Yeah.
Or is there a different shelter in which you're putting the truth in beings into?
And why is it beings, not being?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does seem to have, like, you're saying this idea of sort of like, I think earlier, right, you said a genuine decision. Like, again, I feel like there's this idea of like sheltering the truth or coming to the genuine truth somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess I feel like we should keep going because it's, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we have this paragraph and then we have these four points.
Yeah. Maybe that's, yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
Great. When we hear God and gods spoken of, we think in accord with the kind of representing that has long been customary in that form, which is still indicated most readily by the name, quote, transcendence, a name that certainly is itself already polysemic. Intended is something that surpasses objectively present beings, among them also human beings. Even where particular modes of surpassing and of what surpasses are denied, this way of thinking can itself not be denied. In reference to it, we can even readily survey today's, quote, worldviews.
Yeah, I can summarize that paragraph really quickly. Basically, when we hear the word God and gods, we think of something transcendent, beyond us, beyond human beings, something that surpasses objectively present beings. Mm-hmm. And because we think of transcendence when we think of God, we now have the following worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives us four worldviews. You want to read those?
Yeah. One, the transcendent, inaccurately also called, quote, transcendence, is the God of Christianity. Two, this, quote, transcendence is denied, and the, quote, people itself, its essence left rather indeterminate, is put forth as the goal and purpose of all history. This anti-Christian, quote, worldview is only apparently unchristian, for in essence, it nevertheless agrees with the kind of thinking that characterizes, quote, liberalism.
Okay.
Wait,
what? Yeah, go read it. Go, just read all four and then okay. We'll. I don't know, man. I didn't plan that.
Three, the transcendent is in the above case an, quote, idea or, quote, value or, quote, meaning, something for which one cannot live or die, but which is supposed to be realized through, quote, culture. Four, any two of these transcendences are mixed together. Christianity and ideas of a people, or cultural politics and ideas of a people, or Christianity and culture, or else all three are mixed in various degrees of determinateness. This mixed formation is today the average and dominant, quote, worldview in which everything is intended, but nothing can any longer come to a decision.
Yeah. So what he's saying is interesting. Because the Christianization of the God has resulted in this kind of transcendent idea of God as being surpassing objectively present beings and being transcendent, that fact of transcendence has left us with four possible worldviews. And he gives these four. One worldview is that the transcendent is the God of Christianity. So that would be very standard Christianity. Like a real Christian would believe that. That if there's transcendent, if there's a transcendent in nature, it is my God and he is a Christian God. So that's one worldview. Another view is that this transcendence of a Christian God is denied. It's basically, that would be like, say, let's say an atheist, right? And instead, the people, quote unquote, people, the people, although what that means is left rather unclear, he says, is put forth as the goal and purpose of all history, right? So the people become the goal and purpose of history. This anti-Christian worldview is only apparently unchristian because in essence, it nevertheless agrees with the kind of thinking that characterizes quote unquote liberalism. Now, I don't know.
He doesn't really talk more about that, does he?
Not at the moment. No, but there are things to say about that. I mean, essentially
the anti-Christian worldview is, again, the idea of, let's say, for example, atheism.
Yeah, that God doesn't exist. And in fact, it's the people that transcend everything. And the people are the purpose and goal of history, right?
Right.
And that seems anti-Christian.
Right.
Right? Because it denies God.
Yeah.
He says, but it's only apparently so. Yeah. Because it agrees with the kind of thinking that characterizes liberalism.
Yeah.
Now, why he throws that word in there? And how that has anything to do with this, I'm not quite sure. But we're obviously about to talk a little more about liberalism. So, and I have some things to say about this. But let me go on to the third worldview. The third worldview is that the transcendent is in the above case where the transcendence of God has been denied. The transcendent is instead an idea or a value or a meaning, something for which one cannot live or die, but which is supposed to be realized through culture. So an idea would be something like democracy, or a value would be something like human rights, right? Mm-hmm. Or meaning would be something like, I don't know, belonging to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
These would be transcendent ideas
mm-hmm.
that guide history and are the goal and purpose of all history. And then he finally says the fourth view is that any two of these
Sorry.
Yep.
One question. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's like saying instead of it kind of puts it into it puts in a way the religion or God into culture as opposed to in the church. I mean, I'm not yeah,
that's
sure
right.
That,
I would say, church, well, but. I would say that culture becomes the congregation or the community of believers, and the idea, value, or meaning becomes the God that that community lives for.
Right.
That's right. That's right. And I want to say something about two. Actually, we're dealing with somebody who's writing during Nazism, during an incessant. An incessant beating of the drums of the German people. Okay, this was huge then. Now he doesn't, and of course the Germans weren't the only ones to ever do this. Happens all the time, but that was going on when he was writing, and he was in Germany. So the second worldview is that God, the transcendence of God is denied, but the people, the idea of the people, become transcendent, right?
Mm.
And they become the goal and purpose of all history. Well, that's what the Nazis thought the German people were.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an anti-Christian view, he says, but it's only apparently un-Christian because it still agrees with the kind of thinking that characterizes liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah.
Which is apparently liberalism would be a characterization then of the anti-Christian, the Christian.
Yeah,
and
I think
assume
so.
Also number three. Well, he's maybe about to say that.
You know, we're going to talk a lot about what liberalism is, but what he's saying is that this idea of the people being the goal and purpose of all history, though anti-Christian, is still liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
It still aligns with liberalism, can contain this idea of the people being the goal and purpose of history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, we have number three, the worldview. The transcendent is, in the above case, an idea or value or meaning, something for which one cannot live or die, but which is supposed to be realized through culture. Now, that to me feels like liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Not just liberalism, but any culture that has an idea, value, or meaning that guides it and is supposed to be realized through it, the way God is supposed to be realized through worship and the church.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, it liberalism can align with that as well. So can conservatism. So can certain social utopias and social ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Any political ideology could align with that. Now it goes to number four. Any two of these transcendences. So we have God, the people, or let's call it idea, value, or meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Those are the three transcendences.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's call it God, the people, or a cultural idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Any of these two can be mixed together. So we have Christianity and the ideas of a people. So for instance, you could have a very Christian people who the transcendent for them is themselves as the people and their Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You could have cultural politics and the ideas of a people. So you could,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
A certain group of people and cultural politics. Let's say, for instance, liberals, right?
Mm-hmm.
The transcendence of the liberal people and their cultural politics,
mm-hmm.
are united together. Or you can have Christianity and culture, which, you know, is true. You could have a culture that is very Christian, not a people. Maybe it's a diverse culture that doesn't have a sense of a single united ethnic group or peoples, mm-hmm. And they can be brought together.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, or else all three are mixed in various degrees of determinateness. This mixed formation is today the average, mm-hmm. and dominant worldview. So this mixed formation of God, or say, let's say Christianity, the people, and a cultural idea, is the average and dominant worldview in which everything is intended, but nothing can any longer come to a decision. Right?
Yeah. Do we have to keep reading? I can't decide.
No.
Okay.
I don't think we do.
Okay. I mean,
I think it's a good place to stop and turn.
Yeah, great.
Right?
Yeah.
I want to say that really quickly before I finish this little passage here. There's a lot of writing. I just listened to a book called A World After Liberalism. And one of the most interesting things about this book, it discusses like five different sort of writers who envisioned a world after liberalism in one way or another in the 20th century. And those writers, and also the alt-right, is discussed. And one of the most interesting aspects that this book brings up is that Christianity in these writers is sort of blamed as being the force or the mindset that has that, I mean, these are anti-liberal writers, that gave birth to liberalism. So they see liberalism as simply just a secularized form of Christianity for various reasons. And the writer points out that it's interesting because liberals, of course, generally view themselves as being a remedy to Christianity, right? Like Christianity is seen as conservative, religious, repressed, and liberalism is seen as an antithesis to that, as a solution. But these writers, who are anti-liberal writers, view liberalism as simply a new form of Christianity. So where Christianity comes to play in the liberal, non-liberal dichotomy is very interesting, depending on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And Heidegger kind of raises some of those complexities here. I think that's something we can touch on later, but I think we should move on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
Yeah.
But I think that brings us to our next point, which is that, as you know, I was going to talk about something.
Mm-hmm.
Should I just proceed?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel it's time. I've been thinking this all week, and mostly because of our last couple episodes, I think it's time to address the fact that we've used and we'll definitely use again the word liberalism in this podcast in a way that seems to have some negative connotations. And, beautifully enough, we read this passage from Heidegger tonight, didn't plan that at all. And he brings up this word liberalism, which I don't think it appears very often in the book.
No, it doesn't.
And there it is. All right. So I think it's important that we contextualize our use of this word and any kind of critical overtones our presentation of it may seem to emit. So first off, I mean, this is essentially a podcast that we're seeking to discover and enact a transition of inceptual thinking in philosophy as well as in life and consciousness in general via Heidegger's ideas. But we also obviously tend to branch out into politics and psychology primarily via like politicized discussions about identity and liberalism and via psychological ramblings about identity and anxiety. But even using these words like philosophy, politics, psychology doesn't quite feel right since like as kind of for me as a faithful like Heideggerian, I'm kind of skeptical about attempts to differentiate them as like areas of thought. I'm also skeptical about the idea that they're not inherently all sort of emanations of the same kind of ontic underzone. But probably as people listen, they're gonna have this sense of us talking philosophically and then maybe moving into politics and maybe onto psychology and maybe into art or theater or parenting or something. So I think it's probably acceptable to kind of admit that these categories are going to occur, that there's going to be politics in this podcast, and there's going to be psychology, even though essentially this podcast is a philosophical podcast. So with that in mind, let's get back to this word liberalism. I think the best and first thing to say is that our unpacking or criticism of liberalism is, I think, in a sense, not political, but instead personal. We're not here to change political affiliations. We're here to change philosophical assumptions. And as I believe I mentioned briefly in the first episode, both of us, I'm going to talk for you a little bit in here. If I go beyond that, what you want to say, please let me know right away. Both of us are liberals. I would say in the same way someone might say they are Islamic, Catholic, or Jewish because they were raised quite strictly within one of those religions and identities. And I'd say it goes even further than that since both of us are in a sense liberal academics raised by liberal academics. Both our fathers are very strictly liberal professors at two of the most liberal universities in the country. But it doesn't stop there. We are such liberal Brahmin that each of us attended the same university system right. our father teaches at.
I just thought of that.
And crazy. Those two universities are two of four in the country that make up the academic government corporate triad that in recent years was formed to control and monitor public information so that it adheres to fact, i.e. liberal fact, which is frankly a top-down approach to social communication that I find rather perplexing to say the least. But and of course, both our mothers are very strictly liberal as well. And all four of our parents have been liberal activists for decades. Both our fathers have written and taught from a strictly and strongly liberal perspective. Liberalism was and is the de rigueur ideology of both of the households we were brought up in. And my mom even said to me once as I was leaving for college, quote, "You can come home as anything you want except a Republican." And I have little doubt your parents feel the same way. Yeah. So when I say strictly liberal, I am intentionally inviting echoes of devout Catholics, Orthodox Jews, or fundamentalist Muslims. In other words, the holy creeds and mental formats of liberalism were not just enforced in our households. They were so embedded in their discourses and cogitations as to be practically indistinguishable from talking and thinking themselves. The tenets of liberalism, which I think we hope to be uncovering and discussing throughout this podcast, were so unquestioned in the homes, schools, and communities in which we were born and raised that even figuring out what they are feels like a kind of deprogramming or reverse engineering or a methodical Freudian back-clamoring that slowly unravels and sheds light on hitherto unknown dynamics, practices, and dictates. Which is to say, figuring out the being of liberalism is for us a quest that is highly integral to our more general quest of figuring out what the being of bang, truth, identity, anxiety, thought, art, theater, and our very selves are. Reading this book by Heidegger is really about analyzing our mentations, our world, our perspectives, and the attitudes, ambitions, and assertions of liberalism have been semantically and emotionally encrypted into those things. And hence into us since we were born. But of course, they have been encrypted into so much more than just us, which is another reason I think we'll be bringing up liberalism with some frequency as we talk about our so-called world. But on a personal level, we want to decode liberalism so we can understand its influence on our minds, so we can be free of any negative consequences and unconscious adherence to politicized patterns of thinking may have on us. For instance, in our search for a new perspective on anxiety, on identitarianism, and on what Heidegger calls machination or bewitchery or historiology, we look to the light of a new philosophical method and experience that sets us free to discover truer and maybe even more livable aspects of existence. But beyond that personal level, we've come to the realization that much of what we're discussing when we branch out of ourselves and head into current theories, intellectual cultures, or politicized institutions, wherein the people we are talking to and about via this podcast gain so much of their information and sense of belonging, so much of what we're talking about when we discuss the first beginning, contemporary philosophy, and the narrative algorithms of the contemporary world are imbued with liberalism to the same depth and extent that we ourselves are. In other words, liberalism is not just a political stance in contemporary America that seeks to stave off and eradicate conservatism. Liberalism, due to the hyperdominance of liberals in the arts, education, publishing, media, and entertainment industries, is kind of the animating spirit of the nation's philosophical body, I would say. The thoughts and ideals of liberalism are so intricately interwoven into the way art is practiced and curated, the way courses are structured and taught, the way books are written and discussed and awarded, the way theories are conceived of and tested, the way facts are presented and defended, the way stories are crafted and cherished and shared, and even in the way social media feeds are compiled and censored and distributed, that you can't really attempt to create an other beginning philosophically out of what currently exists without putting liberalism on the operating table. And while I would say that, of course, metaphysics, ethics, science, technology, and a host of other intellectual practices need to be on the table at the same time, including conservatism, liberalism needs to be on there at a more basic level because it is, as it were, the religious or at least the dogmatic presence that inspires and guides and at the same time delimits and degrades them all. So a few more points I seem important to make. First, while liberalism pours through our veins, it has also been thrown at our heads. Both of us have been the target at one point or another of professional and personal attacks by liberals, which is not something either of us can say about non-liberals. This has left us wondering, what is going on? Why such attacks happened, are happening, and what ideas are behind them? So there's that. Second, I believe both of us are concerned about and opposed to the degree to which quite a few liberals, not all, but some, have embraced and engaged in censorship. Speaking for myself, I am an absolutist when it comes to free speech, and I believe that for liberalism to actually be liberal, it needs to renounce all censorial practices. Both of these things have left us longing for what I would call a, quote, better liberalism, and I'd be happy if our critiques can be seen as solely carried out to achieve that goal. Finally, speaking just for myself, there's something in all this that stems for me out of my theatrical ambitions. Ultimately, I see my purpose as a playwright to achieve a mimetic universality that allows me to feel, conceive of, and portray the principled humanity of every action. Or, as theater people say, every character believes their motives to be good. And to perform a character, and playwriting is ultimately character performance, you must believe them to be so. Yet I have come recently to the realization that my liberal upbringing was one of the things that was keeping me from that high and, in my mind, necessary artistic and perceptual ideal. As a playwright, I crave an ideological neutrality from which to observe and empathize with the world so that I can understand and depict it. I do not need, at least to anywhere near the same degree, to exorcise, as it were, my conservative bias to achieve that neutrality. My liberal bias, however, is another story. So, yeah, liberalism. We have debated a lot off mic about how much to use this term, how much to discuss our feelings about it, how much to sound like we are critical of it, not only because we don't want this to be a political podcast, and further, not only because we realize that we stand to lose perhaps a few ears and maybe even opportunities if we are too critical of it, but also because we know that some people are going to take our criticism, or let's call it our rethinking of liberalism, as meaning that we are therefore rejecting the beliefs of liberals and sanctioning the beliefs of conservatives, but that is not the case. Our goal is not to get into our political beliefs, again, largely because this is not a political podcast. We want to continually head back to philosophy, no matter how far off we stray as we muse on other topics. We are not advocating for any political position. We're not claiming one position as right or wrong, and we are not here to insert ourselves into the political debates of the time. There are enough podcasts doing that. And if you were to ask what our political positions are, so you can know if you are listening to a liberal or conservative podcast, my answer would be, we are trans political. For our quest to know the truth of Bang puts us outside the liberal conservative binary. Yet being trans doesn't always mean you weren't born one gender or another. And for both of us, that gender was liberal. And that is, I think, why we are going to talk a lot more about liberalism than we are conservatism on this podcast. I actually don't think either of us identifies as conservative, and I certainly don't, if only because I don't identify as anything. But both of us were long ago identified as liberals. We were told we were liberal. We were made liberal. We were indoctrinated with liberalism. And that's the past programming we hope to deconstruct and free ourselves from through our discussion of liberalism, so that now and then we can glimpse a feeling of the freedom of thought outside the closed walls of political partisanship and follow Heidegger into the other beginning, if only to see if there's anything better there than there is here. And that's all I have to say.
Yeah, well said.
So,
yeah, totally. I mean, this is a totally non-eloquent addition.
Please now speak.
But just like what you're saying at the very end, yeah, I think, I mean, I don't even know what a conservative, like, viewpoint or perspective would be, which is why I think, like, I have no knowledge of what it would be. So that's why we don't talk about it much, I think.
Yeah, absolutely not. Well. I mean,
and I think the reason we do start talking a bit about politics is here and there is to try to make it the things we're talking about philosophically have like feel really relevant to today, or like how we can apply them in today's situations.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I think is good.
That's right. Yeah.
Because it can get philosophy can get very abstract. And the same with psychology or anxiety. I think it's this very same reason.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, I think that's kind of what I was saying at the beginning. I think that, you know, politics, psychology, art, theater, parenting, bringing philosophy into all those things, it really just means like bringing philosophy into all the aspects of our live-a-day world, you know?
Yeah.
And trying to ground it and contextualize it and give it a little
make
bit
of... Make it real.
Make it real. Yeah, exactly. I think your thing about reading is interesting. I was realizing today, you know, I've been reading some conservative books lately, like in the last, you know, 6 weeks. And of course, I've been reading for decades. And I mean, I think 99% of the books I've read had nothing to do with conservatism, or if they had anything to do with conservatism, they were simply openly critical of it. I have embossed myself with the liberal canon, embossed my brain with the liberal canon. I am nothing but a wax stamp of the liberal canon. And so reading even just a few conservative books has been fascinating, really fascinating. Just it's like discovering a lost tribe with a lost language and a whole new way of looking at things. And that's been really interesting. But you're right. Mm. That's to say, I agree with you, the degree to which conservatism lies in me, I would say could be quantified by the number of books I've read. And I would say 99% of the books I've read are not about conservatism. I have very little knowledge of conservative ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think is a problem.
Yeah.
Actually, I want to be more informed about conservatism. I'm only reading conservative books now. I mean, other than Heidegger, I'm reading books by conservatives because I think it's just really eye opening to see what is going on out there outside of the bubble I was raised in.
Mm.
And it's about achieving that ideological neutrality and that balance that I talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I bring up some points in here that I think I'd like to hear your if you agree with me on. I mean, I said to what I consider to be a little, you know, sort of, I said a few heavy things, I would say. Like, well, let's say I was, as I said, I used the word liberal with some negative overtones a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to get your response to my use of them, use of it in that way. Like, so for instance, I brought up the fact that in recent years, there's been this academic government corporate triad, they call it, that has formed. So that's basically corporations, the U.S. government, and four universities have teamed up together to control and monitor public information so that it adheres to fact. And, you know, I said I find that to be a top-down approach to social communication that I find rather perplexing. I guess I'm being a little critical of that. I am a little skeptical about the academic government corporate triad that is trying to control and monitor public information so that it adheres to fact. Because, in fact, that fact is, of course, liberal fact.
Yes.
Do you have anything to say about that, or do you disagree with me?
I'm not
or?
Even sure where to start on that one. I think the most obvious example, and then I think you should give your ChatGPT example, is anyone who's posted anything other than a food photo on Instagram has potentially gotten the flag of content. And as everyone knows, I don't even know where to start on this, just the level of censorship that happens on social media is astonishing.
Yeah, and you're saying that it's liberal biased, or what are you saying?
Well, it depends, but in general, it does seem to be liberal biased, or at least just the censorship element in which suddenly, you know, the rules are interpreted in the interpretation I don't know. Again, I'm not even sure what the conservative bias would be, but there's like an insane censorship going on on social media right now.
I think maybe to call it liberal conservative is not even correct, but yet you have the sense that it's coming from liberal perspectives, not from conservatives. Conservatives, of course, are very good at censoring and have censored a lot. And I mean, certainly in the 90s, art censorship by conservatives was a huge thing. But as social media has come to be born, and the censors...
Well, who owns it, and what's there, you know, that would be...
Yeah.
And it seems that most...
We're not alone in saying what we're saying. A lot of people claim
media companies are.
Yeah, a lot of people claim this liberal bias in censorship. Whether it's true or not, it's a claim that a lot of people make. But that goes to the second point.
Wait, what about the ChatGPT example? You don't want to give that. It's a great example.
I mean. I don't know how good an example that. I mean, what? I did some tests on ChatGPT the other day, where I said, "Give me 10 Instagram captions that make me sound blank." I said that make me sound liberal, and it gave me 10. I said that make me sound conservative, it gave me 10. That make me sound Democrat, gave me 10. That make me sound Republican, gave me 10. That make me sound like a social justice warrior, gave me 10. That make me sound like I support critical race theory, it gave me 10. That make me sound alt-right. And it said, nope, that's an extremist ideology. And I said that make me sound like I support Hamas. And it said, nope, that's an extremist ideology. Now, I think it's important to point out, I can't... Now, you could certainly say that that literally an artificial intelligence engine refusing to even give captions that support the alt-right is liberal, but I'm not sure its definition of Hamas as an extremist ideology is liberal, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm not sure it's necessarily a good example. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what...
Well, I think... I guess it's just
if you want to go further and say, I brought that up to my friend
who's
very liberal and he was very for that censorship, that's true. But that's just one guy.
Yeah.
That's just one guy.
I guess it's just being an example of how the censorship feels lots of places that you wouldn't expect it to be. Like you would think that ChatGPT, which is supposedly like an, you know, OpenAI, which is made by OpenAI. You would think that they would not, but then they are making decisions about what's not allowed.
Yes. I think my point when I was speaking with my friends about it was that, let's say, for instance, it was perfectly comfortable giving me 10 captions for social justice warrior and critical race theory, which to some people are extremist ideologies. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It was not comfortable giving me captions for alt-right, which to some people is an extremist ideology. So, you know, it has, it seems, a liberal bias in terms of how it determines extremist ideologies. Hamas might not be that much of rocket science to figure out that it's an extremist ideology, although there's lots of people who would disagree.
Yeah.
They would say Israel is an extremist ideology, you know? I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
But let's leave that there.
Yeah, sure.
Let's leave that there. I think I want to hear, you know, I mentioned something. I said that both of us have been the target at one point or another of professional and personal attacks by liberals. Now, what do you think? I mean... You know, when I wrote that, I thought, well, I must have been the target of personal and professional attacks by conservatives, too. But I couldn't think of a single instance.
I know. The best example I have of that is the club in Manhattan. And I guess I'm not supposed to name still.
No,
but like,
don't name names.
They commissioned a work of mine,
yeah.
And then they apparently, I don't know quite the order. They went to the board, and then they told me that they were decommissioning it because of the Me Too movement. My artwork definitely is authored by a woman, and definitely myself, and has very sometimes uses sexual imagery, though never.
Okay, that's liberal censorship. I hate to break it to you.
Wait, what? Me saying on myself or them?
Them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So then.
I thought you were giving us an example of like conservatives attacking you.
Oh no! I know. I'm talking about liberals. I don't know conservative. That's what I don't. I don't know. I was talking about liberals.
You've been attacked incessantly by liberals.
I know. I'm giving an example.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I'm just giving an example of what that would be. So okay. So
we've had shows canceled. You've had death threats. You've had
yes, I have had lots.
You've been sexually assaulted. I mean, yes, it goes on and on.
All by liberals. So that's all there is to say.
Okay, great. That's all I wanted to say. You know, same
but
here.
But no, I don't know any conservatives. Or I mean, I don't know any.
I don't even know any. I don't know how they could attack me. Yeah. I don't know any.
Well, they're not in the arts.
No, they're not in the arts. They're not in the theater world. They're not, you know, yeah, I don't know. Anyhow, so I think what that's worth saying is that, you know, in our life, which has been surrounded by liberals, we've been attacked on ideological grounds. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, that leaves us kind of eager to find out why those attacks occurred and what the ideas were behind them. So when we talk about mm-hmm. liberalism, I think we're also looking for some of those ideas to understand those attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know. It's a fraught topic.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like another thing that we've discussed a lot off mic is like if that's even the right word. And we've decided to keep it.
That's right.
Given what you said. But we have spent time being like, is it identitarianism? Is it actually radical left?
Yeah, they call it radical left, you know, that kind of
thing.
What is
it? But it does seem, and also this idea that you know, hopefully there is a truly liberal space, a genuinely liberal space that is, like you mentioned in what you were saying, something that we could discover or come back to. But I think it seems that we've just decided that liberal is the word used these days, and in a way it's taken away from its original definition of what
that's what they
is.
Say that's what they say, and I'm not sure that's even
what do you mean
I'm not even sure that's true anymore.
That the original definition of liberalism
is something that you can say was 100% good.
That's
all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, there's this idea of, like, true liberalism is absolutely good, and it's something we can all get behind.
Right.
And some aspects of liberalism has become bastardized and questionable and illiberal. The illiberal left, I've heard it called, you know, all that shit. Anyhow, I think it's worth questioning. Everything is worth questioning. Mm-hmm. It's worth questioning if there is and was ever a golden age of liberalism, which would all liberal ideas mm-hmm. were philosophically sound,
mm-hmm.
ethically sound. I just don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think for me, I think the word liberalism is unfortunate. It's hard. I mean, meaning it's hard to use it because I don't know if it really accurately describes what I'm talking about.
I know, yeah.
But I think we're stuck with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think as we work with it, as we move through Heidegger, I think hopefully we'll come to understand what we mean by it and inevitably what he means by it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's very interesting that he used that word today.
Because I think that, context. For instance, when he says, liberalism in quotes, I my sense is what he means is kind of probably enlightened, mm-hmm. educated, leftist, so-called enlightened, so-called educated, so-called progressive thinking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Such as one would find at a university, and Heidegger was very much a university man.
Mm-hmm.
But what he says here is interesting, because he says this worldview of the people being the transcendent goal and purpose of all history is very much in line with the kind of thinking that characterizes liberalism. And I think he says that because what he wants to say, I think it was what he wants to say is this idea of the people is not sub-liberalism or is not to be denigrated or dismissed as being primitive or illiberal, because liberalism is synonymous with being advanced, right?
Mm-hmm.
And being enlightened, and in a certain sense being right.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say being everything you do has been researched, verified, and confirmed as proper. And so it's interesting that he uses liberalism right there, especially if this second worldview that he talks about, where a transcendence is denied and the people is put forth as the goal and purpose of all history,
mm-hmm.
speaking from Germany at that time, and then to say, and this thinking, it agrees with the kind of thinking that characterizes liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
He's literally linking. I mean, he is right here.
Yeah.
Liberalism with the ideas of the German people that were emerging at that time.
Yeah.
So he is making, in my view, a very strong connection and maybe even a condemnation. And pointing out that the German folk, as they were being preached about, developed, and inevitably militarized and mobilized for heinous crimes, this vision of the people or a people agrees mm-hmm. with the kind of thinking that characterizes liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not below enlightened thinking. It's not different than enlightened thinking. It lines right up with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Heidegger says. And right away, that's something, that's an idea about liberalism that I think, you know, heavy, right?
Yeah, not popular.
Not popular.
Definitely not popular.
Not talked about.
Yeah.
But asserted here and interesting to ask about and interesting to question.
Mm-hmm.
What liberalism is and how it could, can liberalism fall in line with the kind of thinking that is about a people having a determinate goal and purpose in history? Or is a certain people, is, you know, because if you have a people, that people is necessarily not other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels antithetic to liberalism, but maybe it's not. Because, for mm-hmm. instance, I would say that liberals are a people. They view themselves as a people. The way they talk, I know many of them. And the way they talk, mm-hmm. the people who are not liberals are not in their tribe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different tribe. It's a different people. The liberal people are moving in a certain direction. They're doing their things. They have laws, they have rules, they have perspectives, they have a religion. It's liberalism. And the people who don't have it are not their people. And that means they're a different people.
mm-hmm.
And for a political ideology that has as one of its core tenets, our diversity is our strength, to divide people into people seems to me to be a little counter that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an aspect of liberalism that mm-hmm. I think is interesting to talk about.
I mean, can it just be said like that there are identifying races? Is that part of it? They're just saying that there are...
What?
That there are race, like that there are groups of people. Well, actually, okay. I actually wanted to say, and we can get back to that question, which I'm not quite sure how to say. I also think it's really interesting how liberalism and in a way, well, how it's also here really in conversation with a religion, right? So Christianity, and then those who deny Christianity, and how those who deny Christianity, like we were talking about this in the last podcast, those who, you know, replacing a story with another story is just another version of story. So just what I'm surprised by is just how Christianity, atheism, being related to Christianity, and then also liberalism and culture all really feel of a thing.
Yes.
So like,
yes,
culture or liberal, like liberalism being the new religion, or
yeah.
Yeah. Or culture, identity, idea, value. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Does
right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, it almost seems that given liberalism's appearance in that second worldview, that it, that is about detranscendencing God and denying the transcendence of God and turning into the people, and then boom, liberalism. It almost seems as if liberalism is the result of the detranscendence of God. That you detranscend God, you say God is not transcendent, mm-hmm. the people are, and you have liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, liberalism is 1 degree away from a transcendent God. It's mm-hmm. it's phase two. You detranscend God, you get liberalism. So it's not, it's like,
mm-hmm.
they sit right up next to each other. They're father and son, mother and daughter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're very related.
Yeah.
And liberalism probably contains aspects of its forebears.
Yeah. Yeah, which is like the big challenge with this idea of the other beginning is how, like, I feel like all of this is obviously within the first beginning, and like how to even get outside of these mental structures or philosophical structures is ultimately the goal, but really hard, because really hard to get out of it using its own language, which is kind of one of the things I like, is I do feel like he kind of develops his own language to try to help us get out.
Yeah. And I mean, that's little what I talk about, you know, what I just talked about, which is that, you know, my primary motive in deconstructing liberalism is to try to figure out what on earth I know and have experienced that is not liberalism.
Yeah.
Like, and how its forms of thought have basically, you know, kind of mapped my thought.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I say, like, we've been made liberal. We've been identified mm-hmm. as liberal. We've been impressed into liberalism just by being raised in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't even... It's just like very hard to figure out where liberalism ends and where I begin.
Yeah.
And how the thought patterns of liberalism have perhaps given me patterns of thought that I don't even, that I never chose.
Yeah.
And I know you've talked about that in the context of anxiety.
Oh, definitely.
And you've been personally shocked at times to think the degree to which liberalism was kind of silently and systemically and consistently built in and around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Made you you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I say here. It's like for
yeah,
us,
it's, well said
it's like a personal quest. It's like...
Yeah.
you know, it's that's why I say it's sort of like, you know, you meet people now and they're like, yeah, I was raised in the church, you know. I was raised in the church. I mean, I went to church 4 times a week and I went to church camp and I went to, you know, my parents, we prayed every night around the dinner table, right? Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. And then they get to a certain age and they're like, you know, it so determined how I see the world that I want to try to figure out what on earth it was and how it made me and how I can maybe see something outside it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, for me, the essence of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
And I think there's a subtext there of like, maybe it's at the root of some of my quandaries.
Yeah.
Right? It may be.
Yeah.
May not be. It may be at the root of some of my strengths too.
Mm-hmm.
It may be the reason I am who I am in a beautiful way, but it also may be dragging me down. It may be lifting me up and maybe dragging me down, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's definitely done both.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, everything has,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it feels so unknown and so granted and given.
Yeah, and very taboo to talk about.
And there's a taboo about talking about it, of course. Because it's politics, and if you talk about it and you question it and you criticize it, it all of a sudden imagines like you're crossing the aisle.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it is. And that's not what's going on.
Yeah.
That's not what's going on. If we're crossing the aisle, it's into freedom. You know, whatever that means. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we're trying to head.
That's where we want to cross.
Yeah. But, anyhow, yeah, so we brought that up just because I think to try to give some context to the things that I think we're probably going to be talking about a lot in the coming years, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's it.
Yeah, that's great.
Nothing else to say?
No.
All right. Love and peace. Peace and love, everybody. Love you. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.